So then, that was the second point about the ground. The third point is definitive verification. So I'll start by reading through what it says in the commentary and then try to remember everything Rinpoche said about it. The third point, called definitive verification, applying to the meaning of this, is explained as embracing in full the path of application. Are you familiar with that term, the path of application? Yeah, it's the path of accumulation, path of application, path of vision, path of meditation, and the finally perfected path, the five lam. So definitive verification refers to the second of the paths, the path of application. Which is, and then that path is described as being comprised of appropriate mental cultivation based on the purport of the sutra collections of Mahayana. If one wonders why it is called definitive verification, the term indicates that through cultivating the mind on the paths of accumulation and application, through nurturing the three types of precise knowledge, prajna, in accord with the content of the sutra collections, the meaning of pure being is definitively verified, that is to say, confirmed. The difficult part of this technically is that we have the translation in one book and the Tibetan in another, and Rinpoche's commentary is in connection with the Tibetan. So I'm having a little trouble following the connections between the two. So the commentary starts out by saying, what is this definitive verification thing all about? And it seems that, in fact, the path of this term, definitive verification, can apply to both paths of application and accumulation, both the first and the second, according to the commentary. I'll have to think about that a bit. Because usually it's only applied to the jhalam. It seems that, as the way I understand the commentary, it's applying the term both to the path of accumulation and path of application. But it applies most specifically to the path of application, because that's the path on which the real work of getting into the emptiness takes place. Mainly on the path of application, one is purifying negative karma, and one is starting to hear the teaching, we're starting to get the basic ideas clear, and collect enough merit to be able to work with the teachings effectively. And then that effectively working with the meaning of the teaching, and getting into an understanding of what our emptiness is, takes place on the path of application. So then, the central term here is definitive verification, which at this particular spot is called ngurzin. So it's a synonym for ngurzin, and ngurzin means identifying what the emptiness is all about. Identifying means getting to know, coming to be able to recognize what is pure being. the way that one gains this recognition of pure being is described as taking place through the three types. What kind of substance is it? Is it that are transformed? So the introduction to substance, ingredients of awareness in form of the vessel in common shared, a transformation to suchness is undergone. Of the sutra collections, Dhammada to itself, a transformation to suchness is undergone. Of awareness components of sentient beings not shared, a transformation to suchness is undergone. So it's three different areas, three different types of materials. And the introduction to the ingredients themselves, that is, the substance of this complete transformation, is presented in this context as being comprised of three aspects. There is a complete transformation into suchness of the awareness, that is to say, that which appears in the form of the world of the vessel, which is seemingly shared in common, that which operates as signifiers in the form of letters, names, and statements of the sutra collections, undergoes a complete transformation into the suchness of the Dharma Dhatu, the expansive phenomena itself. And there is a complete transformation into suchness of the collection of principles of awareness, consisting in conscious mind and mental derivatives. Those components of sentient beings which comprise their individual mind streams and are not shared in common. Thus, the transformation which is undergone should be known as taking these three forms. So that's the commentary. Then Rinpoche asks, if this is a transformation of mind, then in what sense can we call it a transformation of the outer world? And as you know, in the discussion earlier, when we were talking about what is experience in common, then it turned out that the outer world is only seemingly... It's Maitreya Radio. Straight from Tushita. What was I saying?
Undergoes a complete transformation.
That sounds familiar. Right, we were talking about what's experience in common. And at that point, when we're talking about what is experience in common, what is not, then it was anything that appears in physical form, in other words, what you can see with your eye, or what you can hear with your ear. So forms and sounds are experienced in common. But that doesn't mean, as we found out at that point, it doesn't mean that because many different beings can see a mountain, it doesn't mean that the mountain is there. You don't need a mountain out there to explain how all of these different people can see it. And we went through all the arguments for that. Maybe that's not necessary at this point. I'm just reminding you of the territory that we've covered. But the argument went something like, because each mind stream that sees the object is different, then there can't actually be common experience. And since there's not really common experience, it means that what is experience actually is the awareness belonging to the individual. In other words, the transformation of the outer world is actually a transformation of awareness. Or put it the other way around, if your awareness is transformed, then your way of seeing the outer world will be changed. So that's the way in which outer world can be transformed. If there was a truly existent outer world consisting of atoms sitting out there
somewhere in the galaxy, then it wouldn't be possible to transform it. It would just be what it is, and that's finished. You know, you can't do anything with that. It's too big. Too complicated. But since it's only awareness, then change the way of looking at it, you change the whole thing. It's a little bit like what Rinpoche was talking about in the morning session one time when he came in. The appearances are mind only, and we can understand that by seeing that if you're walking through a flower garden and you're in a good mood, then you see the flower garden is very beautiful and everything is very pleasant. So, but if you're in a very negative state of mind, then even the flower garden will appear to you in a negative form. You will not see the beauty of it. You'll see it won't seem beautiful. So in the same sort of way, if you change your mind, then you change what you experience on the outside. And this transformation of the outside world, so-called outside world, is called a complete transformation into the suchness of the awareness that appears in the form of the world of the vessel. And this kind of transformation involves two things. So it is not only the outer world, but also bodies, the bodies of the beings. So here, the outer world is what is presented directly in the text, what is mentioned in the root text is outer world. But that includes the bodies, which exist by force of the outer world, or they exist in connection with it. Then we'll come back to that point again later. We'll look at each of these transformations in more detail, but first kind of get the general idea of each. And the general idea of the second one is that there is, now this is a complicated sentence, you may have trouble understanding, because it's circular. It's completely circular, the sentence. So it's a little bit hard to find out what is changing to what. But I'll read it up again from the commentary and then we can look at it. So that which operates as signifiers means the things which are used to express something, right? And that means the letters, the names, and the statements found in the sutra collections undergoes a complete transformation into the suchness of the Dhammadhatu itself. So what this means is that there is a Dhammadhatu of the sutra collections, and that is transformed into the real Dhammadhatu. So in other words, the texts on the sutras on the emptiness explain about the Dhammadhatu. So that's the Dhammadhatu of the sutra collections. It's what is referred to. That Dhammadhatu which is referred to by the names and the letters and statements in the sutras. So that's the Dhammadhatu of the sutra collection. And since that is a Dhammadhatu referred to by words, it's not the real one. Because the real one is beyond terms and names and letters and what can be expressed. But you need the Dhammadhatu of the sutras in order to even get the idea of what Dhammadhatu is. So the sutras point it out, they point your mind in the direction of the Dhammadhatu and make it possible for you to realize the actual Dhammadhatu. So that's the sense of this, right? General idea. And then the third, so that was a transformation relating to speech, relating to conventions, terminology, and so on. What?
That ordinary speech?
Well, we'll get back to that. This is just general kind of introduction, and then we go in more detail about what kind of speech and what's, you know, the deeper sense of it. Then the third transformation, to put it briefly, is a transformation of mind. The first is body, second speech, third mind. There's a complete transformation into suchness of the collection of principles of awareness. So that refers to conscious mind and mental derivatives. Conscious mind is a term in Tibetan is called sosem, could also be translated primary mind, and it refers to the sogdruk, the sixfold collection of consciousness, and that means the five sensory consciousnesses and the rational consciousness. So the six of those are called conscious mind. When you when you're looking at something, then your it's your eye consciousness perceiving a form, and your mental consciousness applying the name to that form. And for example, the name flower. If the form is, belongs to a flower, if the rational consciousness judges that that form is the form of a flower, then it puts on that name. So any kind of conscious process involves these, the five sensory consciousness and the mental or rational consciousness. So they're called conscious mind here. Then mental derivatives refers to the what otherwise is collected under the fourth skanda, which in the Sutrayana tradition involves the 51 mental events, or in the Vajrayana they are listed as kuntokchuje, the 80 forms of conceptuality. And those are referred to as mental derivatives because they derive from the conscious process. So with the sixfold collection of consciousness as the base, the mental derivatives manifest. For example, you look at a beautiful form, so the eye consciousness is involved, the mental consciousness is involved in judging it as a beautiful form, and that sets the mental derivative of desire into motion. So desire is a mental derivative. So is it clear how mental derivatives and conscious mind work together? It's not clear. So we try another example. Your eye sees a form, and your rational consciousness puts the name enemy on the form. Then the feeling of anger arises. So anger is the mental derivative based on the primary conscious process of just seeing and judging the form seen. So in that way, conscious mind and mental derivatives go together. Under mental derivatives, you have desire, anger, jealousy, pride, and so on. All different kinds of emotions and behavioral patterns, let's say. The 51 in all, 51 main types of reactions to the contents of the sensory experience.
And this is transformed into suchness?
Yeah, and this is transformed into suchness, and at this point we haven't gotten to the bottom of that, what's that involves. That will come in a detailed explanation. The connection. It just happens like that.
Right? I mean,
they go together. The one follows on the other, also in time. So first, also in time. So first, the eye consciousness perceives the form. At that point, there's no concept. It's just a form. Then the mental consciousness applies the type of name that one is associating with that form. In this case, we're saying enemy, right? Then because the rational consciousness said enemy, then comes the reaction anger in the next instant.
Yeah? Where did it come from?
From the patterns in the mind, from the habitual patterns.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Well, all the different types of consciousness are grounded in the alaya. They all come from there, are built up from there. Rinpoche sometimes compares the alaya consciousness to the ocean. And then the afflicted consciousness, the seventh, is compared to the wind. And when the wind blows in the ocean, it makes waves. And the waves are like all of the rest of the processes of consciousness, like the appearance of forms, the appearance of the eye consciousness, along with the reactions of the mind to what it sees.
I mean, in fact, my
so it all goes together.
Is it appearances? I mean, the anger or the pain, is it an appearance? Is
well,
it an
no.
object of duality?
Strictly speaking, what's meant by appearance there is the actual form seen by the eye. In that case, so the eye sees form, the thinking mind puts on the name enemy, and once you're relating to that form as enemy, then the feeling follows, right? Comes out of that. If the rational mind had put on the name friend, then the feeling would be different. So So which page were we on?
24 in the
commentary.
24 in the
primitive. Oh, thank you. So those are called, the conscious mind and mental derivatives are called the components of sentient beings which comprise their individual mind streams and are not shared in common. So that covers the general explanation of these three. Now we go into a more detailed explanation. Since no phenomenon of any sort whatsoever exists, which is not included under the expansive phenomena, the Dharmadhatu, the transformed qualities present within the untainted expanse, when the transformation has been undergone, are inconceivable in number, covering in their extent the entire range of host phenomena in all their aspects. So this term Dharmadhatu then is a term that belongs to fundamental nature of mind. We're talking about that level of mind at this point. We're no longer talking about the more superficial levels of mind with forms appearing and reactions to them and all of that. We're talking about fundamental mind. But there's a relation between fundamental mind and all of those contents in mind in the form of appearances. And the connection is that there is no sort of an appearance which is not included within the expansive phenomena. So since anything that can be experienced by mind is included within that expansive phenomena, then when the transformation has been undergone, then all of those, the entire variety of appearances and phenomena turns into an expanse of qualities instead of just limited dualistic phenomena. They become the collection of excellent qualities. In the same sort of way that if you change your state of mind, then you change what you experience.
Are those qualities are within yourself?
Yeah, all of those qualities are the contents of mind already. So in the untransformed state, they would be, they would correspond to the pneumon, for example, right? The disturbing emotions, desire and jealousy and all of those. In the transformed state, they correspond to the wisdoms, the five wisdoms. We'll come back to that point. So the statement here is that the number of positive qualities that would be present after the transformation is actually without any limit. It's inconceivable, the number of qualities. You couldn't possibly count them up. But here they're being summarized in terms of three. So we're saying the three main qualities.
What is a host phenomenon?
Yeah, this we talked about the first time, so I didn't explain it now. Okay, we go back. The term host phenomenon is one that I made up in connection with this text. And it may be a term that can be used for useful for something, and it may be something we may have to remove in a later edition. It depends on whether there's a revolution, whether it causes a revolt among the Buddhist ranks, and my life is in danger. Yeah, well, I'll need Vajragards, yeah. The term in Tibetan is chuchen. We don't have our blackboard here, so I can't write it down. But it's chu as in phenomena, and then cha, you know, this first cha, cha na chin. Chuchen.
How did you translate it, Pardon? How did you translate
host phenomena.
Host?
Host, yeah. And host means someone who is taking care of somebody else, right? And actually the term is, the way that it would be used here is in the case of biology, where you have a host and then a parasite. You know, like the cow is the host for the parasites in its stomach, you know? It's that kind of idea. And that's the picture. Because a chuchen is that which bears pure being. Chuchen means, it's a very tricky term, because what it means is chunichen, that which has pure being. And what it is it's a synonym for chu. So every time he comes up, Rinpoche says, chuchen nam chu. So it's just another way of saying phenomena, right? But we have this funny word, right? The phenomena or the bearer of pure being.
It's a bit like qualified and unqualified, isn't it? Like the same relationship. Like chuchen is that which has the quality or has the thing that you see the chuchen.
Yes.
What has the Dharma tar?
Yes, what has the Dharma tar?
So the Dharma haver.
The Dharma haver, yeah.
Put it literally.
Yeah, exactly. It's the bearer of pure being.
And the word bearer is almost too strong, isn't it?
Well, that's another way of saying haver.
Yeah. I mean, haver is always too strong, but we use it more loosely as well.
Yeah. But the trouble...
It's not like it carries it, it's something separate.
No, it's not meant as something separate.
Because, you know, if you think of the parasite, for example, there is too, isn't
it? Yeah, well, there's obviously duality. We're using language, right? So we're stuck with language.
The image is getting, you know, more and more solid, I think, if
you use. Well, it's a very tricky term, and I didn't know what to call it. I mean, one way to translate it would be to say the embodiment of pure being.
Yes.
That sounds very nice, but there's a problem with that. And that is that in English, the word embodiment tends to indicate an ideal expression of something. So in that case, if you say the embodiment of pure being, that means that phenomena would be the ideal expression of pure being, and that's exactly the wrong picture. Because the phenomena is the deluded state of pure being. So I wanted to avoid that possibility of misunderstanding it by feeding in a term which doesn't mean anything, and hoping that it will somehow give the picture. And it seemed to me too clumsy to translate it as havers of pure being, or bearers of pure being. So it doesn't give many possibilities of what to call it. But as long as we understand the term, then what we call it doesn't matter so much. Yeah, Chuchen is also used in that way.
Okay, I thought it was.
Yeah, the same Chuchen. Okay. But there it doesn't mean the same thing. The Tibetan is even, if you think the English is difficult, the Tibetan is 100,000 times worse, because the terms all mean something else in every context. Right? You just think, you thought you understood it now, right? Then it comes up in another context and means something completely different. Or something very different, anyway. But anyway, to put it briefly, host phenomena is just another way of saying phenomena. So, to get back to where we were, the text said there is actually an unlimited number of positive qualities after the transformation, but here we're going to summarize them under three. And the three are the transformation of the vessel, and by force of that, the transformation of everything appearing as bodies, which is the attainment of the body of phenomena, normally called Dharmakaya, which is the omnipresent suchness in which there is neither a center nor outer boundaries. So Rinpoche's comment on this was, what happens to the outer world and bodies when one is purified of the dualistic delusion with respect to them, is that they will be transformed into the Dharmakaya. So becoming free of the dualistic delusion is the key. Then he went into some detail about the Tibetan word shukchi. If you have the Tibetan commentary, it's on page 26 in the first line. Dear nu dande shukchi lu, lu sunanwa. And the idea of that is that the transformation of the outer world means the transformation of everything that can appear to an eye consciousness, everything that is visible. And since bodies are also visible to an eye consciousness, then they are also included under the transformation of the outer world. And one can speak of body in a coarse way, as this big chunk of meat, or one can think of it in a slightly more subtle way as being the five sense faculties. The transformation of consciousness with respect to these, when one's consciousness is free of the dualistic idea of there being perceived objects and perceiving mind as two things, that transformation will be an attainment of the Dharmakaya. And what does Dharmakaya mean? It's very useful at this point to look at the Tibetan, because it's chu ku. And what we're talking about is distinguishing chu and chu ni, phenomena and pure being. It's very interesting that Dharmakaya is called phenomena body, literally. And now maybe we can see the logic of that, of why it's called that. This, the word ku is the honorific for body. Right? So the chuku is like the body phenomena, literally translated. And that makes perfectly good sense in the context here, because the transformation that has been attained is a transformation of bodies, of heavenly bodies like planets and world systems, and of all of the bodies of the beings. So what you get out of it is a like a super body phenomena. Chiku. It's the ultimate Mr. Universe or Miss Universe. Something like that. But what actually comes out of it is something very different from what we usually think of as bodies, which are limited things, having a center and an edge. This body phenomena, chukku, is said to be omnipresent suchness, which has no center and no edge. So that's the ultimate body. Then the second transformation is transformation of one's dualistic relation to speech. So it says in the commentary, the transformation of everything included under the process of speech. And this answers the question that you asked before. You were asking what is meant by speech here. The answer is everything included under the process of speech. The word is translated as process here in Tibetan is duze, which means formation or the composite process. So everything which is a composition of speech or different formations of speech is transformed. And the sutra collection here is only being used as the example, because the sutras are seen as the most perfect expression of speech.
Is it speech only or is it sound?
Yeah, it would be sound also.
But in this case, so sound is not with the form.
It's not with what?
Sound is not with the form.
Sound relates, or what do you say, it goes hand in hand with form in the sense that it is experienced in common by beings, just like forms are. So they go together.
So in which case does it belong? In the first or the second?
It would belong specifically in the second one, yeah. Sound belongs in the second transformation.
Because
And then, from our conceptual viewpoint, sounds are usually organized into meaningful sound. Right? Like, for example, in the Donald Duck comic books, the cow says moo in English. It says something else in Danish. It says something else in German. let's take birds. The birds say chirp chirp in English. What do they say in German? Chip chip in German. Peep peep in Danish. And what about frogs? In English they say croak. So we take these sounds and we organize them into meaningful combinations for ourselves, right? And the way that each language organizes the sounds is different, right? But the principle is the same, that, you know, as with our mind, we take the sound and we translate it into something meaningful for ourselves and say, this sound means this, right? And it's the kind of sound a frog makes. So all sounds somehow or other become connected up with the language. So even the wind makes a sound, right? Whish. The wind says whish in English. Well, maybe. Yeah, Asterix has sounds for things which we never even... Yeah, the sound of hitting somebody in the face is different from the sound of hitting them in the ass. Right? In the comics, it's a different sound. So there's this kind of... Because our mind functions conceptually and we want to get a conceptual meaning into everything, then we relate to sound in this way. And when the transformation has been undergone, then this conceptual dualism is transcended, and something quite different comes out of sound. There's a transformation into the suchness of the Dharma Dhatu itself, it says, which means that one gains the attainment of the body of enjoyment, which is a translation of Sambhogakaya. And that means the melodious, the mastery of the melodious sound of Dharma in an uninterrupted flow of qualities knowing no end. And this is the sort of thing that is also found in the Vajrayana practices. For example, in the practice of Devachen, the leaves on the tree behind Buddha Upame in Devachen are teaching the Dharma. Right? The sound of the leaves is the sound of the Dharma. And that same sort of a thing is expressed here, that after the transformation, all sound will become the sound of the Dharma. So it will be an uninterrupted flow. It will be a spontaneous kind of Dharma teaching. There won't be any artificiality in it. It will be happening spontaneously. No, but but if you're hearing only the sound of Dharma, then you're hearing the sound of pure being, as it were. And in that sound, there's no suffering. You know, so that's the kind of sound that we are trying to experience when we, for example, make music. One is trying to imitate the sound of pure being, the sound of pure bliss, the sound of pure enjoyment. You know, one's trying to translate the feeling of enjoyment into a sound, right? And of course, for a being who is working dualistically, then any sound is experienced from the perspective of concepts. So it turns into a source of suffering. So pleasant sounds we attach to, unpleasant sounds we have aversion against. So if the sound of great praise is flowing in at you from all directions, right? Everybody's saying what wonderful qualities you have. You know, this music of people praising you. And they all say, you know, your translation is the best thing we have ever seen. And so on and so forth. That's just one of the things that they could be said. Then, you know, if you're an ordinary being, then you get pride, because it's the mental derivative that will be the reaction to that praise will be pride and other forms of attachment, right? And because of the pride, then you get suffering, right, of various kinds, and cause other suffering. So even being praised goes in it has a negative reaction. And if on the other hand it is blame, and everybody's saying, where did you get this term, you know? How can you translate it like this? You know, this is complete nonsense, and nobody even uses this term. And, you know, it's blame or criticism is coming. That obviously causes suffering, because we relate to it from our dualistic concept. But, you know, what we were trying to achieve in the first place by even having a mind, you might say, what the Buddha nature is trying to get us to experience is pure bliss. So this impulse to experience pure bliss is coming from our nature. Our very nature is Buddha nature, which is perfect in itself and is pure bliss. So to go through the transformation where all of the delusion of the conceptual apparatus is purified away means that one gets back into contact with one's own fundamental nature and will experience that bliss, in this particular case in the form of sound.
Because I have always been thinking why I'm speech and
Yeah, because the transformation of speech is the Sambhogakaya.
And is it maybe because I thought that maybe...
So the next one is the transformation of mind. In the commentary it says, the transformation of that which comprises mind, namely the all-inclusive base and the sevenfold collection supported by it, which is the attainment of the emanation body, Nirmanakaya, endowed with the understanding accompanying the five forms of original wisdom. We've already talked about these terms, all-inclusive base, that's the Alaya Vijnana, and the sevenfold collection is the afflicted mind, afflicted mentality. That's that aspect of consciousness which looks towards the all base and thinks, I, this is me, this is mine. And given that idea of I, then that functions like a wind stirring up the ocean of the all base and manifesting the waves of the five sensory consciousnesses with their objects and the rational consciousness with its thoughts. So this is another way of saying what we said earlier, that all outer appearances are the manifestation of the habitual tendencies in the mind. Here we're just talking about it purely as consciousnesses. So when these are transformed, this is tulku. The Tibetan for nirmanakaya is tulku. And tulku means emanation body. Akanishta. It's north of Greece somewhere. Maybe Denmark, yeah. And then he manifests in our realm in order to demonstrate the path. So it's this double level way of looking at it. So it depends on whether you're taking it from the Drongdon perspective or the Nyingma. But from a Drongdon perspective, in terms of the provisional meaning, then a 10th level bodhisattva's realization in comparison with the Buddha's is something completely different. It's the difference between having a partial transformation or a complete. So. Where did we get to? So this was the statement that that the transformation undergone has basically happened at the first level, but is not complete until Buddhahood. So then we've arrived at the second point in the outline, Dor Ten Padang Jivar Shepalang Ni. So the second point is the expanded explanation of the details of the subject of transformation. And that expanded explanation itself has two parts, a brief presentation and an expanded explanation. So first the subject is presented briefly in terms of 10 headings. And Rinpoche said that you need 10 different points to approach this subject of transformation because it is so profound. So it's difficult for us to fathom what it is and how deep it is. So in order to try to communicate the whole picture, these 10 points are needed. So the commentary here, well, let's read the root text. This 10-point presentation of transformation provides an unsurpassable introduction because it is the way to approach the essence, ingredients, and individuals, the special traits, requirements, and ground. Mental cultivation and application, the disadvantages and benefits. This 10-point presentation, enabling knowledge as well as accomplishment of thorough transformation, provides an unsurpassable introduction because it is the way whereby one both comprehends what is actually meant by thorough transformation and puts it into practice, whereby the ultimate among results is attained. So this is the reason why it's called unsurpassable. And there are two parts to it. That because of these 10 points, one comes to a knowledge or an understanding of what transformation is, and one also has the drupsul, the way of establishing it. One has a hold. If you use these 10 points, then you have a way of establishing what transformation is. And this word establishing, or drup, that's used here, is one of these protean Tibetan words, one of these chameleons that means about approximately 84,000 things. And Rinpoche, in his protean mind, in his ability to change from one form to the next according to the situation, explains the terms in different ways in different contexts. So I've translated it according to one way that he explained it, and today explained it in a different way. This has happened several times, actually, as we've gone along here, and especially with the droop.
Maybe it depends on the group.
It depends on the group and, what seems to need to be said at that point. In Tibetan, it's possible to do that in Tibetan, but in English, unfortunately, you have to pick one of the possible terms for drupa, and once you've chosen that, based on Rinpoche's explanation, then it only means that in English, right? And then you're stuck when he explains it in some other way. But since this is a very friendly group, and nobody has been throwing tomatoes yet. Well, I have to tell you, because the way explains it doesn't quite go with the translation. Because the way I translate it is enabling knowledge as well as accomplishment. And this is on page 23 of the commentary. And what I translate as accomplishment, Rinpoche explained today, is more in the sense of establishing through logic. One is able to understand transformation and establish it in a logical way for oneself, or understand it through logic. And he mentioned that there are two different drupsus, two ways of establishing something through logic. One of them is to take a negative approach, Gakpa Goni Drupsu, a way of establishing things through refuting them, through refutation, which is a kind of negative approach, excluding all possibilities until what is left is what you're looking for. And the other is Drupa Goni Drupsul. And there, even in those words that Rinpoche is using, there are two different... he's using drup twice, but it means two different things in the way that in the meaning of it. This one is a positive way of establishing and a logical understanding of something. So in the first way, you say what a thing is not. And in the second way, you say what it is.
As a consequence of the first one, or another way of doing it?
Usually in the text, the first one is presented first. First saying what it's not, and excluding the wrong idea of it. And then the way is cleared, as it were, to say what it is, without misunderstanding it. And that's also the way this text proceeds. That first, we have talked about chu, which is what what is not chuni, that the whole sense of consciousness as being dualistic, a dualistic delusion connected with our way of thinking, that is not pure being. So that's the gakpe drupsun. And once you've eliminated that, then you can say, well, if it's not that, then what is it? And then this positive way of saying what it is what we gain through these 10 points. These 10 points will tell us what it is. What is pure being actually? So because this way of proceeding allows for both a precise knowledge of transformation and also a way of establishing it logically, it is called unsurpassable. You can't find a better explanation. And then another reason is given for why it is unsurpassable, and that is because it is the way whereby one both comprehends what is actually meant by thorough transformation and puts it into practice, and through that achieves the final result. So it's very important that we know what these 10 are. You know, if someone asks, well, enlightenment, that's a very nice idea, but how do you get there? The answer would be these 10 points. Is exactly how you get there. So what are these 10 then? The text says, Chupo di kangxena. If somebody should ask, what are these 10? Then the answer would be rongxinam ngô, the essence. And here essence has the same meaning as rongxin, which is usually translated nature. But it means the makeup, the constitution or the makeup, what the thing actually is. Right? Then the second point is ze, the ingredients or the materials or the things that have to be transformed. So if we're going to talk about a transformation, it has to be a transformation of something. And in this case, what is actually transformed is the outer world, the vessel of the outer world, along with the bodies that manifest by force of that outer world. That's the first thing. Second is speech. All of the all forms of speech or sound are transformed, and also mind in every aspect, in every sense. So, in other words, body, speech, and mind, both as we normally understand it, as an exterior set of phenomena, as well as the internal phenomena. So in other words, every aspect of experience is transformed. Then the second point is the individuals, meaning the candidate. Who is a candidate for this transformation? Who constitutes a suitable sort of a... Third. Did I say second?
Yes.
It's because Hannah was confusing me. No, never mind. It's the third. Good thing somebody's keeping an eye on me. And we'll see who these candidates are, the individuals who are the suitable vessels for this transformation. Then there is the what makes the difference. This word chepar in Tibetan means difference. This is what was translated as the special traits. because of the way this is explained. But basically it just means the differences. And in this case it would mean that the differences in the different kinds of transformation that are experienced by different kinds of beings. So it turns out that this transformation has, there are different kinds of it. And those kinds go with different kinds of beings. Then there's the gopa, the requirements, what is needed in order for this transformation to come about. And what's it good for? And what's the purpose of it? Well, as Rinpoche said, kari pengire, what's it good for? What can we use this transformation for? Then the next point is the is ne, which is again translated as ground, which we have seen it translated that way consistently throughout. And it's ground in the sense of the basis. What is the basis for the transformation? And here, Rinpoche went into an explanation of sesame seeds to try to give some sense of the basis or the support for the transformation. The seed is the support for the sesame oil. There's like the container or the thing that the oil is based on. And also, if we're talking about gold, then the support for the gold would be the gold ore, that from which one can refine the gold. So if you take away all of the baser elements from the ore, then what will be left will be the gold. If you take away the husk and everything that's not the oil, then what will be left will be that essence of the sesame seed, the oil. So we have to find out what is the support or the basis or the grounds for this transformation. And that turns out to be a very extensive point. We'll see when we get to that. Very complicated point. Then the next one, Hannah can tell you which one. I keep losing track of the number. Seven. Really? Then the next one is yila zepa, which means literally doing in your intellect. Literally translated, doing in the intellect. Being mentally active. But that's only the literal translation. It has different senses in different contexts. Here it's translated as mental cultivation, which again doesn't fit with the way Rinpoche explained it today. Today he explained it more as meaning attitude. Your attitude, what you're doing in your mind, what you do to things in your mind, your way of looking at them, your attitude towards them. And he explained it from the perspective of the three yanas. So if you're yila zepa, if the way you do things in your mind is that you are practicing the path in order to pacify your suffering because you can't bear suffering, then that would be the mental cultivation or the attitude that goes along with the Hinayana path. If you're practicing in order to benefit beings, so you want to achieve the transformation out of compassion for beings in order to be able to show the path to others, then this would be the mental attitude of the Mahayana. And if you're practicing with a Vajrayana attitude, it means that you have basically the same attitude as in the Mahayana. You will go through use the skillful means of the Vajrayana to accomplish pure vision or sacred outlook, as is sometimes translated, in order to be particularly well equipped to benefit beings. So those are the three basic ways that one could approach the practice, and it's absolutely crucial for what for what sort of practice you actually are doing. Because if you are practicing the Vajrayana and using the skillful means connected with that, but you're doing it just with the idea of gaining a very nice state of mind, getting all sorts of special powers and getting a nice state of mind, like as if you're, for the sake of your own comfort and satisfaction, then even though the methods that you are using may be Vajrayana methods, what you are actually doing is just the activity of a completely ordinary person, because that's the state, the kind of attitude you have. The attitude of a completely ordinary person is they do things in order to have a nice time, to get a nice state of mind and be comfortable and have a nice life. That's a complete ordinary way of looking at things. So that's not the Vajrayana, even though the methods one might be using would be. It only becomes true Tantra or true Vajrayana practice if the attitude is a Vajrayana attitude. So that was that point. Yes, I just did.
Well, no, you didn't actually. You said it's Mahayana class. You said something about you want to develop a
sacred outlook, pure vision. Pure vision is the specific view of the Vajrayana. Dakparabjam, it's also called. The view of universal purity. So that's the view you develop in the Vajrayana with the intention of benefiting beings through developing that view. So that intention is basically the same as the Mahayana. It's just that the view is slightly different, and the means that one is using are also different. The skillful means are of a different sort of character. Is it clear? No. I mean, if it's Vajrayana, then it means it involves this pure vision, applying especially skillful means with the wish to benefit beings.
The means is a difference in the method. I was more wondering, the difference in the aspiration?
Well, it's also a slightly different aspiration. Your aspiration in the Vajrayana is to achieve pure vision. Whereas the aspiration what you're trying to achieve in the Mahayana is the realization of emptiness, mainly. Rinpoche didn't explain that. I'm just telling you what he said. But when he gives a chance for questions, then that would be a good one to hop up with. What is this pure vision? But in fact, we're going to be getting something about that even in this text, because even on the Sutrayana level, there's a certain amount of talk of pure vision. So we're getting to something of that even in this text. So then the next one, ninth. Right? Oh, we didn't get Jorwa yet. Okay, then it is the eighth. Jorwa is the application. So Rinpoche didn't explain that. And these are only the headings, in fact. So it's no catastrophe if we don't get the whole picture clear now. he carried on. It's application in the sense of how you apply your mind on different levels of understanding. And we'll get to what that involves later. Then the next point is the disadvantages. And that means... It doesn't mean the disadvantages of going through the transformation. So So it's advising us not to get it too quickly. That's the disadvantages of not getting the transformation. The commentary is very kind and adds that point, the disadvantages of not getting it. And the advantages means the advantages of getting it. So those are the 10 briefly presented, and then we get the expanded explanation of each of those 10 points. The first one being the goal, essence. And there the root text says, of these, the introduction to the essence includes the circumstantial stains and suchness, when these in fact do not and do appear. This is suchness, that untouched by stain. So this is a very enigmatic statement. And it's difficult to understand in the Tibetan, and maybe it's just as difficult in the English, I don't know. At this point I have a hard time evaluating that. But the explanation of it, to go through it quickly first. Of these 10 points, the introduction to the essence or actual makeup of the transformation includes the circumstantial stains and suchness, when these in fact do not and do appear in respective order. That's the key word here, in respective order. This is suchness, that untouched by circumstantial stain, pure being manifesting in complete agreement with its own essence, which is utterly free of blemish. So I read this in the Tibetan about 84,000 times, and it still didn't mean anything to me. Because it's so simply stated, and it just says in respective order, and then you're supposed to figure it out. So in respective order means basically that when the stains, when the adventitious stains do appear, when the adventitious stains do appear, then the suchness does not. And when the adventitious stains do not appear, the suchness does appear. So it is just as simple as it seems to be. And it's actually here that Rinpoche explained what's meant by these superficial stains. We went into that explanation that it's superficial means something that obscures the fundamental nature, that obscuration is a conceptual one, has to do with the way you think, and the obscuration itself does not belong to the essence of mind. So at this point, Rinpoche quoted a verse from the Madhyanta Vibhanga, distinguishing the middle from the extremes, which is one of the 10 points on Laktong, one of the 10 Vipassana points in the 5th chapter on Unsurpassable Vehicle. And it deals with the subject of superficiality or adventitiousness, the adventitious aspect of stains and purification. And it says something like, because it's completely pure by nature like space, to speak of stains or purification is purely from an adventitious perspective, and this is to be free of mistake with respect to adventitiousness. And Rinpoche's explanation of that was that since the stains are not present within the nature of mind in the first place, then there's no real purification of them. And there's also no real state of being obscured. Both states of being obscured or being purified of the obscuration are purely from a superficial perspective. namely from the perspective of your thoughts. So as long as one is thinking in terms of the dualistic appearances, then one is obscured with respect to one is not contacting consciousness in its pure aspect or in its basic aspect. And as soon as that conceptual delusion is gone, then one is contacting the basic nature. Just as in a dream, as long as one doesn't recognize that one is dreaming, one is not contacting the nature of the appearances, but is taking them as being truly existent. And as soon as you recognize it's a dream, then you see that the appearances are only appearances, having no substantial essence. So it may seem sometimes that this point is belabored, that they make too much out of it. And then one hears it again and again and again, and so Rinpoche is constantly hammering on this point. And it's a very subtle point and very important, because most systems, most religious or philosophical systems don't look at it this way at all. That this is really taking it from the perspective that the destination that we are trying to reach is already present. In the Dzogchen, this is called Dangpo Sanje, or original Buddha, or first Buddha, which is one's basic mind. It's that which has been the Buddha from the beginning. And in this particular context, it's called that suchness which has been purified of stain. And one can see fundamental mind from either of those perspectives. Either the natural nirvana, that nirvana which is constantly present as the fundamental nature of mind, or the nirvana which has been freed of the temporary stains, the nirvana which seems to be accomplished through a path, but which is not actually a new nirvana. It's the realization of that original nirvana that has always been there, not a newly created nirvana. And most systems, whether religious or philosophical, would present the solution to whatever is described as the problem as being something quite different from the problem, from the state of the problem. It's as if you achieve a realm which is totally other than what you have now. Either you go to heaven, achieve some paradise realm where everything is hunky-dory and is quite different than what it is now. You have to, get rid of everything that you are in order to become something else. But this system is not like that. It's more like what you're trying to become you already are, and you just have to recognize it. It's like recognizing the dream. So that's a completely different approach, and psychologically much more effective. Yes?
Can I just bring down a question about you, that nirvana and purity and perception are all the same?
Yes.
Okay. Because nirvana is so, I guess, it seems like what you just described, falling into self.
Really?
Well, I mean, from what we do, which, is before one moves or something, we always speak of nirvana, it seems also mystical and everything.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wasn't thinking of nirvana when I was talking about that. I was thinking more of the kind of solution that's presented in other systems. It's a dangerous topic to get into.
Then after you come to realize that you feel like it's the same, if you don't stop
different names. You haven't seen the dawn down to your level, or you think the dawn is, you can't believe that the dawn is continuing itself. Or you think, well, the dawn is happening as big as I thought it was before. More like me.
It's very fascinating, yeah. And it's even in terms of Buddhist paths, it's a more advanced way of looking at it than in the Hinayana path, for example. Because in the Hinayana path, Nirvana is looked at as some funny kind of a state, right? Where you shut off the process of consciousness and just rest in this total cessation, which is definitely not a fundamental mind. So it makes a big difference in terms of what it is you conceive of as being the, you know, the goal that you're trying to achieve. And it also says something important about this transformation that we're talking about here. Because it doesn't mean transformation in the sense of a change of essence. Like changing from being a naughty samsaric being into being a very nice nirvanic being. Well, it's nejur, and ne is the word we've been translating as ground, and jur means to change. Yeah, the usual sense of... Yeah, it's a good question. But certainly, in terms of experience, it's a total change from the way one was experiencing before. So from a psychological point of view, I think it's a good word. Because you know, it's the difference between experiencing impure appearances, which cause suffering, or pure appearances, which are completely free of suffering. And that change that happened there was a change in the way that your consciousness functions. So that, I think, we can call a transformation. But not in the sense that one changes to a different type of being, or one changes one's essence to something else. It's transformation in the sense really of emergence again, as Shenpen was mentioning yesterday, the emergence of that fundamental mind which is there but is only obscured. And this is why Rinpoche uses these examples of the sesame seed and the gold ore. One can transform the sesame seed from this dry state of a little lump into something that's oily. And liquid. And the way you do it is by removing everything that's not the oil. So you transform the solid thing into a liquid thing. But you haven't changed the essence of that thing. You've only removed the adventitious part, the part that didn't belong to the essence. You could call it a refinement if you like, yeah. So then you have to find another word for number song, nam song, because that's what I call refinement. So if you want, this is one of the problems of translation. If you change one thing, you have to go back and change all the 84,000 volumes where you called the other thing that, right? But as long as you understand the meaning, then what you call it doesn't matter so much. Some people call it change of state, rather than transformation. Because there are people who don't like this word transformation. Also among the schools, you know, there's a debate between the Shentong and the Rongtong on this point. So it's important to understand it in the proper way. Call it what? Change of lineage?
Hmm.
Yeah, when it first occurs, that's the first level of bodhisattva.
I didn't understand the question.
She was asking, the transformation, is that the first bodhisattva level?
Oh.
And one can't say that, one can't say it quite like that, because the it's only the beginning of the transformation that starts at the bodhisattva first level, right? And in that connection, Rinpoche actually quoted or referred to a line from the Jhulama, the Uttara Tantra Shastra, where it talks about those who are not purified, those who are both pure and impure, and those who are completely purified. And those who are not purified would be ordinary beings, those who have not achieved this transformation. Those who are, at least the way he explained it today, and those who are partly purified and partly unpurified are those who have gone through the transformation at the first bodhisattva level and removed the coarse level of delusion. Dak, yes. Yeah, first is madak. Madak, madak, dak, dak. What? Yes. Yeah, it's that line, yeah.
Which
part of the Jhulama?
No, path of vision or reflection?
Path of vision is the first bodhisattva level. So the realized bodhisattva is called pure and impure. He's pure in the sense that he's purified of coarse delusion, and impure in the sense that the subtle degree of delusion has not been purified yet. Then the one who is completely purified is the Buddha. No, not even the slightest trace of delusion or tendencies towards delusion. So when this suchness, which is empty of dualism, appears, then the stains which are involved dualism do not appear. And as long as there is any dualistic delusion left, then to the same degree, the suchness will not appear. So when the transformation is complete and there is no adventitious stain appearing, meaning that the suchness appears completely, then this is pure being, which appears exactly in accordance with its own essence, free of any stain. So that is the essence of the transformation. And Rinpoche stopped here and said, we're making it very easy today. Just taking a very short part.